occupancy. You've got 50 starving people out there, lying scattered on the battlefield, so get out there and feed them. Forget that you will have to do this again tomorrow. Forget that you will have to be alert enough to dodge the drunks on the drive home tonight. Just burn, burn, burn. Ideally, at some point, you enter what servers call a rhythm, and psychologists term a flow state, where signals pass from the sense organs directly to the muscles, bypassing the cerebral cortex, and a zen-like emptiness sets in. I'm on a 2 to 10 p.m. shift now, and a mail server from the morning shift tells me about the time he pulled a triple, 3 shifts in a row, all the way around the clock, and then got off and had a drink and met this girl, and maybe he shouldn't tell me this, but they had sex right then and there, and it was, like, beautiful. But there's another capacity of the neuromuscular system, which is pain. I start tossing back drugstore-brand ibuprofens as if they were vitamin C, 4 before each shift, because an old mouse-related repetitive stress injury in my upper back has come back to full spasm strength, thanks to the tray carrying. In my ordinary life, this level of disability might justify a day of ice packs and stretching. Here, I comfort myself with the Aleve commercial, where the cute blue-collar guy asks, "If you quit working after 4 hours, what would your boss say?" And the not-so-cute blue-collar guy, who's lugging a metal beam on his back, answers, "He'd fire me, that's what." But, fortunately, the commercial tells us, we workers can exert the same kind of authority over our painkillers that our bosses exert over us. If Tylenol doesn't want to work for more than 4 hours, you just fire its ass and switch to Aleve. True, I take occasional breaks from this life, going home now and then to catch up on email and for conjugal visits, though I am careful to pay for everything I eat here, at $5 for a dinner, which I put in a jar, seeing the Truman Show with friends and letting them buy my ticket. And I still have those, "What am I doing here?" moments at work, when I get so homesick for the printed word that I obsessively reread the 6-page menu. But as the days go by, my old life is beginning to look exceedingly strange. The emails and phone messages addressed to my former self come from a distant race of people with exotic concerns and far too much time on their hands. The neighborly market I used to cruise for produce now looks forbiddingly like a Manhattan yuppie emporium. And when I sit down one morning in my real home to pay bills from my past life, I'm dazzled by the 2- and 3-figure sums owed to outfits like Club Body Tech and Amazon.com. Management at Jerry's is generally calmer and more professional than at the Hearthside, with 2 exceptions. One is Joy, a plump, blousy woman in her early 30s, who once kindly devoted several minutes of her time to instructing me in the correct one-handed method of tray carrying, but whose moods change disconcertingly from shift to shift, and even within one. The other is BJ, a.k.a. BJ the Bitch, whose contribution is to stand by the kitchen counter and yell, "Nita, your order's up, move it," or "Barbara, didn't you see you've got another table out there? Come on, girl." Among other things, she's hated for having replaced the whipped cream squirt cans with big plastic whipped cream-filled baggies that have to be squeezed with both hands, because, reportedly, she saw, or thought she saw, employees trying to inhale the propellant gas from the squirt cans, in the hope that it might be nitrous oxide. On my 3rd night, she pulls me aside abruptly and brings her face so close that it looks like she's planning to butt me with her forehead. But instead of saying, "You're fired," she says, "You're doing fine." The only trouble is, I'm spending time chatting with customers. That's how they're getting you. Furthermore, I am letting them run me, which means harassment by sequential demands. You bring the ketchup, and they decide they want extra Thousand Island. You bring that, and they announce they now need a side of fries, and so on into distraction. Finally, she tells me not to take her wrong. She tries to say things in a nice way, but you get into a mode, you know, because everything has to move so fast. In Workers in a Lean World, Unions in the International Economy, Kim Moody cites studies finding an increase in stress-related workplace injuries and illnesses between the mid-1980s and the early 1990s. He argues that rising stress levels reflect a new system of management by stress, in which workers in a variety of industries are being squeezed to extract maximum productivity to the detriment of their health. I mumble thanks for the advice, feeling like I've just been stripped naked by the crazed enforcer of some ancient sanctuary law. No chatting for you, girl. No fancy service ethic allowed for the serfs. Chatting with customers is for the good-looking young college-educated servers in the downtown Carpaccio and Ceviche joints, the kids who can make $70 to $100 a night. What had I been thinking? My job is to move orders from tables to kitchen, and then trays from kitchen to tables. Customers are, in fact, the major obstacle to the smooth transformation of information into food and food into money. They are, in short, the enemy. And the painful thing is that I'm beginning to see it this way myself. There are the traditional asshole types. Frat boys who down multiple buds and then make a fuss because the steaks are so emaciated and the fries so sparse, as well as the variously impaired due to age, diabetes, or literacy issues, who require patient nutritional counseling. The worst, for some reason, are the visible Christians. Like the 10-person table, all jolly and sanctified after Sunday night service, who run me mercilessly and then leave me $1 on a $92 bill. Or the guy with the crucifixion t-shirt, someone to look up to, who complains that his baked potato is too hard and his iced tea too icy. I cheerfully fix both, and leaves no tip at all. As a general rule, people wearing crosses or WWJD, what would Jesus do, buttons, look at us disapprovingly no matter what we do, as if they were confusing waitressing with Mary Magdalene's original profession. I make friends over time with the other girls who work my shift. Nita, the tattooed 20-something who taunts us by going around saying brightly, "Have we started making money yet?" Ellen, whose teenage son cooks on the graveyard shift, and who once managed a restaurant in Massachusetts, but won't try out for management here, because she prefers being a common worker and not ordering people around. Easygoing 50-ish Lucy with the raucous laugh, who limps toward the end of the shift because of something that's gone wrong with her leg, the exact nature of which can't be determined without health insurance. We talk about the usual girl things, men, children, and the sinister allure of Jerry's chocolate peanut butter cream pie, though no one, I notice, ever brings up anything potentially expensive, like shopping or movies. As at the hearthside, the only recreation ever referred to is partying, which requires little more than some beer, a joint, and a few close friends. Still, no one is homeless, or cops to it anyway, thanks usually to a working husband or boyfriend. All in all, we form a reliable mutual support group. If one of us is feeling sick or overwhelmed, another one will bev a table, or even carry trays for her. If one of us is off sneaking a cigarette or a pee, the others will do their best to conceal her absence from the enforcers of corporate rationality. Until April 1998, there was no federally mandated right to bathroom breaks. According to Mark Linder and Ingrid Nygaard, authors of Void Where Prohibited, Rest Breaks and the Right to Urinate on Company Time, the right to rest and void at work is not high on the list of social or political causes supported by professional or executive employees who enjoy personal workplace liberties that millions of factory workers can only dream about. While we were dismayed to discover that workers lacked an acknowledged right to void at work, the workers were amazed by outsiders' naive belief that their employers would permit them to perform this basic bodily function when necessary. A factory worker, not allowed a break for six-hour stretches, voided into pads worn inside her uniform, and a kindergarten teacher in a school without aides had to take all 20 children with her to the bathroom and line them up outside the stall door while she voided. But back to Jerry's. My saving human connection, my oxytocin receptor, as it were, is George, the 19-year-old Czech dishwasher who's been in this country exactly 1 week. We get talking when he asks me, tortuously, how much cigarettes cost at Jerry's. I do my best to explain that they cost over $1 more here than at a regular store, and suggest that he just take one from the half-filled packs that are always lying around on the break table. But that would be unthinkable. Except for the one tiny earring signaling his allegiance to some vaguely alternative point of view, George is a perfect straight arrow, crew-cut, hard-working, and hungry for eye contact. Czech Republic, I ask, or Slovakia? And he seems delighted that I know the difference. Vaclav Havel, I try. Velvet Revolution, Frank Zappa? Yes, yes, 1989, he says. And I realize that for him, this is already history. My project is to teach George English. How are you today, George? I say at the start of each shift. I am good. And how are you today, Barbara? I learn that he's not paid by Jerry's, but by the agent who shipped him over. $5 an hour, with the agent getting the dollar or so difference between that and what Jerry's pays dishwashers. I also learn that he shares an apartment with a crowd of other Czech dishers, as he calls them, and that he can't sleep until one of them goes off for his shift, leaving a vacant bed. We're having one of our ESL sessions late one afternoon when BJ catches us at it and orders Joseph to take up the rubber mats on the floor near the dishwashing sinks and mop underneath. I thought your name was George, I say, loud enough for BJ to hear as she strides off back to the counter. Is she embarrassed? Maybe a little, because she greets me back at the counter with, George, Joseph, there are so many of them. I say nothing, neither nodding nor smiling. And for this I am punished later, when I think I'm ready to go, and she announces that I need to roll 50 more sets of silverware. And isn't it time I mixed up a fresh 4-gallon batch of blue cheese dressing? May you grow old in this place, BJ, is the curse I beam out at her when I'm finally permitted to leave. May the syrup spills glue your feet to the floor. I make the decision to move closer to Key West. First, because of the drive. Second and third, also because of the drive. Gas is eating up $4 to $5 a day, and although Jerry's is as high volume as you can get, the tips average only 10%, and not just for a newbie like me. Between the base pay of $2.15 an hour and the obligation to share tips with the busboys and dishwashers, we're averaging only about $7.50 an hour. Then there's the $30 I had to spend on the regulation tan slacks worn by Jerry's servers, a setback it could take weeks to absorb. I had combed the town's two downscale department stores hoping for something cheaper, but decided in the end that these marked-down Dockers, originally $49, were more likely to survive a daily washing. Of my fellow servers, everyone who lacks a working husband or boyfriend seems to have a second job. Nita does something at a computer 8 hours a day. Another welds. Without the 45-minute commute, I can picture myself working two jobs and still having the time to shower between them. So I take the $500 deposit I have coming from my landlord, and the $400 I've earned toward the next month's rent, plus the $200 reserved for emergencies, and use the $1,100 to pay the rent and deposit on trailer number 46 in the overseas trailer park, a mile from the cluster of budget hotels that constitute Key West's version of an industrial park. Number 46 is about 8 feet in width and shaped like a barbell inside, with a narrow region, because of the sink and the stove, separating the bedroom from what might optimistically be called the living area, with its two-person table and half-sized couch. The bathroom is so small my knees rub against the shower stall when I sit on the toilet, and you can't just leap out of bed. You have to climb down to the foot of it in order to find a patch of floor space to stand on. Outside, I'm within a few yards of a liquor store, a bar that advertises free beer tomorrow, a convenience store, and a Burger King, but no supermarket or, alas, laundromat. By reputation, the overseas park is a nest of crime and crack, and I am hoping at least for some vibrant multicultural street life. But desolation rules night and day. Except for a thin stream of pedestrians heading for their jobs at the Sheraton or the 7-Eleven. There are not exactly people here, but what amounts to canned labor, being preserved between shifts from the heat. In line with my reduced living conditions, a new form of ugliness arises at Jerry's. First, we are confronted, via an announcement on the computers through which we input orders, with the new rule that the hotel bar, the Driftwood, is henceforth off-limits to restaurant employees. The culprit, I learned through the grapevine, is the ultra-efficient 23-year-old who trained me, another trailer home dweller and a mother of three. Something had set her off one morning, so she slipped out for a nip and returned to the floor impaired. The restriction mostly hurts Ellen, whose habit it is to free her hair from its rubber band and drop by the Driftwood for a couple of zins before heading home at the end of her shift. But all of us feel the chill. Then, the next day, when I go for straws, I find the dry storage room locked. It's never been locked before. We go in and out of it all day, for napkins, jelly containers, styrofoam cups for takeout. Vic, the portly assistant manager who opens it for me, explains that he caught one of the dishwashers attempting to steal something, and, unfortunately, the miscreant will be with us until a replacement can be found. Hence the locked door. I neglect to ask what he'd been trying to steal, but Vic tells me who he is. The kid with the buzz cut and the earring. You know, he's back there right now. I wish I could say I rushed back and confronted George to get his side of the story. I wish I could say I stood up to Vic and insisted that George be given a translator and allowed to defend himself, or announced that I'd find a lawyer who'd handle the case pro bono. At the very least, I should have testified as to the kid's honesty. The mystery to me is that there's not much worth stealing in the dry storage room, at least not in any fensible quality. Is Georgie here, and I'm having 200, maybe 250 ketchup packets. What do you say? My guess is that he had taken, if he had taken anything at all, some saltines or a can of cherry pie mix, and that the motive for taking it was hunger. So why didn't I intervene? Certainly not because I was held back by the kind of moral paralysis that can mask as journalistic objectivity. On the contrary, something new, something loathsome and servile, had infected me, along with the kitchen odors that I could still sniff on my bra when I finally undressed at night. In real life, I am moderately brave, but plenty of brave people shed their courage in POW camps, and maybe something similar goes on in the infinitely more congenial milieu of the low-wage American workplace. Maybe, in a month or two more at Jerry's, I might have regained my crusading spirit. Then again, in a month or two, I might have turned into a different person altogether. Say, the kind of person who would have turned George in. But this is not something I was slated to find out. When my month-long plunge into poverty was almost over, I finally landed my dream job, housekeeping. I did this by walking into the personnel office of the only place I figured I might have some credibility, the hotel attached to Jerry's, and confiding urgently that I had to have a second job if I was to pay my rent, and no, it couldn't be front desk clerk. All right, the personnel lady fairly spits. So it's housekeeping. And marches me back to meet Millie, the housekeeping manager, a tiny, frenetic Hispanic woman who greets me as Babe, and hands me a pamphlet emphasizing the need for a positive attitude. The pay is $6.10 an hour, and the hours are 9 in the morning till whenever, which I'm hoping can be defined as a little before 2. I don't have to ask about health insurance once I meet Carlotta, the middle-aged African-American woman who will be training me. Carly, as she tells me to call her, is missing all of her top front teeth. On that first day of housekeeping, and last day, although I don't know yet it's the last, of my life as a low-wage worker in Key West, Carly is in a foul mood. We've been given 19 rooms to clean, most of them checkouts, as opposed to stayovers, and requiring the whole enchilada of bed stripping, vacuuming, and bathroom scrubbing. When one of the rooms that had been listed as a stayover turns out to be a checkout, she calls Millie to complain, but, of course, to no avail. "So make up the motherfucker," she orders me, and I do the beds while she sloshes around the bathroom. For 4 hours, without a break, I strip and remake beds, taking about 4.5 minutes per queen-sized bed, which I could get down to 3 if there were any reason to. We try to avoid vacuuming by picking up the larger specks by hand, but often there's nothing to do but drag the monstrous vacuum cleaner, it weighs about 30 pounds, off our cart, and try to wrestle it around the floor. Sometimes Carly hands me the squirt bottle of BAM, an acronym for something that begins ominously with butyric. The rest of it has been worn off the label and lets me do the bathrooms. No service ethic challenges me here to new heights of performance. I just concentrate on removing the pubic hairs from the bathtubs, or at least the dark ones that I can see. I had looked forward to the breaking and entering aspect of cleaning the stayovers, the chance to examine the secret physical existence of strangers. But the contents of the rooms are always banal and surprisingly neat. Zipped-up shaving kits, shoes lined up against the wall, there are no closets, flyers for snorkeling trips, maybe an empty wine bottle or two. It's the TV that keeps us going, from Jerry to Sally to Hawaii Five-O, and then on to the soaps. If there's something especially arresting, like "Won't take no for an answer" on Jerry, we sit down on the edge of a bed and giggle for a moment, as if this were a pajama party instead of a terminally dead-end job. The soaps are the best, and Carly turns the volume up full blast so she won't miss anything from the bathroom or while the vacuum is on. In room 503, Marcia confronts Jeff about Lauren. In 505, Lauren taunts poor cheated on Marcia. In 511, Helen offers Amanda $10,000 to stop seeing Eric, prompting Carly to emerge from the bathroom to study Amanda's troubled face. "You take it, girl," she advises. "I would for sure." The tourists' rooms that we clean, and beyond them, the far more expensively appointed interiors in the soaps, begin, after a while, to merge. We have entered a better world. A world of comfort where every day is a day off, waiting to be filled with sexual intrigue. We're only gate crashers in this fantasy, however, forced to pay for our presence with backaches and perpetual thirst. The mirrors, and there are far too many of them in hotel rooms, contain the kind of person you would normally find pushing a shopping cart down a city street. Bedraggled, dressed in a damp hotel polo shirt two sizes too large, and with sweat dribbling down her chin like drool. I am enormously relieved when Carly announces a half-hour meal break, but my appetite fades when I see that the bag of hot dog rolls she's been carrying around on our cart is not trash salvaged from a checkout, but what she's brought for her lunch. Between the TV and the fact that I'm in no position as a first dayer to launch new topics of conversation, I don't learn much about Carly, except that she hurts, and in more than one way. She moves slowly about her work, muttering something about joint pain, and this is probably going to doom her, since the young immigrant housekeepers, Polish and Salvadoran, like to polish off their rooms by 2 in the afternoon, while she drags the work out till 6. It doesn't make any sense to hurry, she observes, when you're being paid by the hour. Already management has brought in a woman to do what sounds like time motion studies, and there's talk about switching to paying by the room. A few weeks after I left, I heard ads on the radio for housekeeping jobs at this hotel at the amazing rate of up to $9 an hour. When I inquired, I found out that the hotel had indeed started paying by the room, and I suspect that Carly, if she lasted, was still making the equivalent of $6 an hour, or quite a bit less. Carly broods, too, about all the little evidences of disrespect that come her way, and not only from management. They don't care about us, she tells me of the hotel guests. In fact, they don't notice us at all, unless something gets stolen from a room. Then they're all over you. We're eating our lunch side by side in the break room when a white guy in a maintenance uniform walks by, and Carly calls out, "Hey, you," in a friendly way. "What's your name?" "Peter Pan," he says, his back already to us. "That wasn't funny," Carly says, turning to me. "That was no kind of answer. Why do you have to be funny like that?" I venture that he has an attitude, and she nods as if that were an acute diagnosis. "Yeah, he got an attitude, all right." "Maybe he's having a bad day," I elaborate, not because I feel any obligation to defend the white race, but because her face is so twisted with hurt. When I request permission to leave at about 3:30, another housekeeper warns me that no one has so far succeeded in combining housekeeping with serving at Jerry's. "Some kid did it once for 5 days, and you're no kid." With that helpful information in mind, I rush back to number 46, down 4 Advils, the name brand this time, shower, stooping to fit into the stall, and attempt to compose myself for the oncoming shift. So much for what Marx termed the reproduction of labor power, meaning the things a worker has to do just so she'll be ready to labor again. The only unforeseen obstacle to the smooth transition from job to job is that my tan Jerry's slacks, which had looked reasonably clean by 40-watt bulb last night when I hand-washed my Hawaiian shirt, prove by daylight to be mottled with ketchup and ranch dressing stains. I spend most of my hour-long break between jobs attempting to remove the edible portion of the slacks with a sponge, and then drying them over the hood of my car in the sun. I can do this two-job thing, is my theory, if I can drink enough caffeine and avoid getting distracted by George's ever more obvious suffering. In 1996, the number of persons holding two or more jobs averaged 7.8 million, or 6.2% of the workforce. It was about the same rate for men and for women, 6.1 versus 6.2. About two-thirds of multiple job holders work one job full-time and the other part-time. Only a heroic minority, 4% of men and 2% of women, work two full-time jobs simultaneously. The first few days after George's alleged theft, he seemed not to understand the trouble he was in, and our chirpy little conversations had continued. But the last couple of shifts, he's been listless and unshaven, and tonight he looks like the ghost we all know him to be, with dark half-moons hanging from his eyes. At one point, when I am briefly immobilized by the task of filling little paper cups with sour cream for baked potatoes, he comes over and looks as if he'd like to explore the limits of our shared vocabulary, but I'm called to the floor for a table. I resolved to give him all my tips that night, and to hell with the experiment in low-wage money management. At 8, Ellen and I grab a snack together, standing at the mephitic end of the kitchen counter, but I can only manage 2 or 3 mozzarella sticks, and lunch had been a mere handful of McNuggets. I'm not tired at all, I assure myself, though it may be that there is simply no more I left to do the tiredness monitoring. What I would see if I were more alert to the situation is that the forces of destruction are already massing against me. There's only one cook on duty, a young man named Jesus, and he's new to the job. And there is Joy, who shows up to take over in the middle of the shift, dressed in high heels and a long, clingy white dress, and fuming as if she'd just been stood up in some cocktail bar. Then it comes. The perfect storm. 4 of my tables fill up at once. 4 tables is nothing for me now, but only so long as they are obligingly staggered. As I bev table 27, tables 25, 28, and 24 are watching enviously. As I bev 25, 24 glowers because their bevs haven't even been ordered. 28 is 4 yuppie-ish types, meaning everything on the side and agonizing instructions as to the chicken Caesars. 25 is a middle-aged black couple who complain, with some justice, that the iced tea isn't fresh and the tabletop is sticky. But table 24 is the meteorological event of the century. 10 British tourists, who seem to have made the decision to absorb the American experience entirely by mouth. Here, everyone has at least 2 drinks, iced tea and milkshake, Michelob and water, with lemon slice in the water, please. And a huge, promiscuous orgy of breakfast specials, mott sticks, chicken strips, quesadillas, burgers with cheese and without, sides of hash browns with cheddar, with onions, with gravy, seasoned fries, plain fries, banana splits. Poor Jesus, poor me. Because when I arrive with their first tray of food, after 3 prior trips just to refill bevs, Princess Di refuses to eat her chicken strips with her pancake and sausage special, since, as she now reveals, the strips were meant to be an appetizer. Maybe the others would have accepted their meals, but Di, who is deep into her 3rd Michelob, insists that everything else go back while they work on their starters. Meanwhile, the yuppies are waving me down for more decaf, and the black couple looks ready to summon the NAACP. Much of what happens next is lost in the fog of war. Jesus starts going under. The little printer in front of him is spewing out orders faster than he can rip them off, much less produce the meals. A menacing restlessness rises from the tables, all of which are full. Even the invincible Ellen is ashen from stress. I take table 24 their reheated main courses, which they immediately reject as either too cold or fossilized by the microwave. When I return to the kitchen with their trays, 3 trays in 3 trips, Joy confronts me with arms akimbo. What is this? She means the food. The plates of rejected pancakes, hash browns in assorted flavors, toasts, burgers, sausages, eggs. Scrambled with cheddar, I try. And that's... No, she screams in my face. Is it a traditional, a super scramble, an eye-opener? I pretend to study my check for a clue, but entropy has been up to its tricks, not only on the plates, but in my head. And I have to admit that the original order is beyond reconstruction. "You don't know an eye-opener from a traditional?" she demands in outrage. All I know, in fact, is that my legs have lost interest in the current venture and have announced their intention to fold. I am saved by a yuppie, mercifully not one of mine, who chooses this moment to charge into the kitchen to bellow that his food is 25 minutes late. Joyce screams at him to get the hell out of her kitchen, please, and then turns on Jesus in a fury, hurling an empty tray across the room for emphasis. I leave. I don't walk out. I just leave. I don't finish my side work or pick up my credit card tips, if any, at the cash register, or, of course, ask Joy's permission to go. And the surprising thing is that you can walk out without permission. That the door opens, that the thick tropical night air parts to let me pass, that my car is still parked where I left it. There's no vindication in this exit, no fuck you surge of relief. Just an overwhelming, dank sense of failure pressing down on me and the entire parking lot. I had gone into this venture in the spirit of science, to test a mathematical proposition. But somewhere along the line, in the tunnel vision imposed by long shifts and relentless concentration, it became a test of myself. And clearly, I have failed. Not only had I flamed out as a housekeeper/server, I'd forgotten to give George my tips. And for reasons perhaps best known to hardworking, generous people like Gail and Ellen, this hurts. I don't cry, but I'm in a position to realize, for the first time in many years, that the tear ducts are still there and still capable of doing their job. When I moved out of the trailer park, I gave the key to number 46 to Gail and arranged for my deposit to be transferred to her. She told me that Joan was still living in her van and that Stu had been fired from the Hearthside. According to the most up-to-date rumors, the drug he ordered from the restaurant was crack, and he was caught dipping into the cash register to pay for it. I never found out what happened to George. Two, scrubbing in Maine. I chose Maine for its whiteness. A few months back, in the spring, I'd been in the Portland area for a speaking engagement at a local college and was struck by what appeared to be an extreme case of demographic albinism. Not only were the professors and students white, which is, of course, not uncommon, so were the hotel housekeepers, the panhandlers, and the cab drivers, who, in addition to being white, also spoke English, or at least some R-less New England variant thereof. This might not make Maine an ideal setting in which to hunker down for the long haul, but it made it the perfect place for a blue-eyed English-speaking Caucasian to infiltrate the low-wage workforce, no questions asked. As an additional attraction, I noted on my spring visit that the Portland area business community was begging piteously for fresh, employable bodies. Local TV news encouraged viewers to try out for a telemarketing firm offering a special mother's shift. The classic rock station was promoting job fairs, where you could stroll among the employers' tables, like a shopper at the mall, playing hard to get. Before deciding to return to Maine as an entry-level worker, I downloaded the Help Wanted ads from the Portland Press Herald's website, and my desktop wheezed from the strain. At least three of the 1,000 or so ads I scanned promised fun, casual workplace environments, and I pictured flannel-shirted teams bantering on their afternoon cider and donut breaks. Maybe, I reasoned, when you give white people a whole state to themselves, they treat one another real nice. On the evening of Tuesday, August 24th, still summer but with back-to-school sales shouting for attention from every shopping center, I arrive at the Trailways bus station in Portland and take a cab, since it's too late in the day to pick up my rent-a-rec, to the Motel 6 that will be my base until I find the prerequisites of normal citizenship, job, and home. This is, admittedly, an odd venture for anyone not involved in a witness protection program, to leave home and companionship and plop down nearly 2,000 miles away in a place where I know almost no one and about which I am ignorant right down to the most elementary data on geography, weather, and good places to eat. Still, I reason, this sudden removal to an unknown state is not all that different from the kinds of dislocations that routinely segment the lives of the truly poor. You lose your job, your car, or your babysitter. Or maybe you lose your home because you've been living with a mother or a sister who throws you out when her boyfriend comes back, or because she needs the bed or sofa you've been sleeping on for some other wayward family member. And there you are. And here I am, as clueless and alone as I have ever been in my grown-up life. One of the steps AA asks of recovering alcoholics is to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of themselves. And now, alone in my motel room, I find myself fairly obsessed with my stuff, how much of it there is and how long it will last. I have my laptop and a suitcase containing t-shirts, jeans, and khakis, three long-sleeve shirts, one pair of shorts, vitamins, and an assortment of toiletries. I have a tote bag stuffed with books, which will, along with the hiking boots I've brought for weekends, turn out to be the most useless items in my inventory. I have $1,000, plus some small bills crumpled in pockets. And now, for an alarming $59 a night, I have a bed, a TV, a phone, and a nearly unobstructed view of Route 25. There are two kinds of low-rent motel rooms in America. The Hampton Inn type, which are clearly calibrated rather than decorated to produce an atmosphere of menacing sterility. And the other kind, in which history has been allowed to accumulate in the form of carpet stains, lingering deposits of cigarette smoke, and Cheeto crumbs deep under the bed. This Motel 6 is in the latter category, which makes it homier, you might say, or maybe only more haunted. Walking out from the main entrance, through the VIP auto parts parking lot, you reach the Texaco station with a Clipper Mart attached. Crossing the turnpike from the Texaco, a feat that, performed on foot, demands both speed and nerve, brings you to more substantial sources of sustenance, including a Pizza Hut and a Shop and Save. This is, of course, a considerable step up from the situation described in J.G. Ballard's harrowing novel, Concrete Island, in which the hero crashes onto a median island and finds himself marooned by the traffic, forced to live off the contents of his car and whatever food items he can scrounge from the debris left by motorists. I bring pizza and salad back to my room for dinner, telling myself that anything tastes better when acquired at some risk to life and limb, like venison fresh from the hunt. How many people, other than fugitives and refugees, ever get to do something like this? Blow off all past relationships and routines, say bye-bye to those mounds of unanswered mail and voicemail messages, and start all over again, with not much more than a driver's license and a social security card to provide a thread of continuity to the past. This should be exhilarating, I tell myself, like a dive into the frigid New England Atlantic, followed by a slow, easy swim beyond the surf. But in those first few days in Portland, the anxieties of my actual social class take over. Educated, middle-class professionals never go careening half-cocked into the future, vulnerable to any surprise that might leap out at them. We always have a plan, or at least a to-do list. We like to know that everything has been anticipated, that our lives are, in a sense, pre-lived. So, what am I doing here? And in what order should I be doing it? I need a job and an apartment, but to get a job, I need an address and a phone number, and to get an apartment, it helps to have evidence of stable employment. The only plan I can come up with is to do everything at once and hope that the teenagers at the Motel 6 switchboard can be trusted to serve as my answering machine. The newspaper I pick up at the Clipper Mart bears the unexpected news that there are no apartments in Portland. Actually, there are plenty of condos and executive apartments for $1,000 a month or more, but the only low-rent options seem to be clustered in an area about a 30-minute drive south in the soothingly named town of Old Orchard Beach. Even there, though, the rents are right up at Key West levels, well over $500 for an efficiency. A few calls confirm my impression that winter housing for the poor consists of motel rooms that the more affluent fill up in the summer. On Cape Cod, too, rising rents for apartments and houses are driving the working class into motels, where a room might go for $880 a month in winter, but climbs to $1,440 a month in the tourist season. The Cape Cod Times describes families of four living squeezed into one room, cooking in microwaves and eating on their beds. You get the low rates after Labor Day, and your lease expires in June. What about a share, then? Glenwood Apartments, not its real name, in Old Orchard Beach, is advertising a room at $65 a week, share bath and kit, with a woman described to me on the phone as a character, but clean. And I think, hey, that could be me, or at least my new best friend. Navigating with my Clipper Mart map, I reached the declining and evidently orchardless beach town at about 10, and am shown around Glenwood by Earl. He repeats the character, but clean, part about my potential housemate, adding that they are giving her a chance. I ask if she has a job, and yes, she does cleaning. But I'll never meet her, because the place is so disturbing, to the point of probably being illegal. We go into the basement of this ramshackle combination motel and boarding house, where Earl indicates a closed door. The kitchen, he says. But we can't go in now, because a guy is sleeping there. He chuckles, as if sleeping in kitchens is just another one of the eccentricities you have to put up with in the landlord business. So how do you cook? I want to know. Well, he isn't in there all the time. The room itself, just down the hall from the kitchen, is half the size of my little outpost in Motel 6, and contains two unmade twin beds, a two-drawer chest, a couple of light bulbs on the ceiling, and nothing else. There is no window. Well, there is a window-like structure near the ceiling, but it offers a view only of compacted dirt, such as one might normally see when looking up from the grave. I walk back to the main street of town and set up my office at the payphone near the pier, from which I secure invitations to view a few more apartments. Forget the shares. At the Seabreeze, I'm shown around by a large, contemptuous guy who tells me there are no problems here, because he's a retired cop, and his son-in-law is a cop, too, and everyone knows this. But I can't tell whether I'm supposed to feel reassured or warned. Another putative plus, he keeps down the number of children in the place, and the ones that he gets don't make any trouble, and you can take his word for that. But the rent is $150 a week. So it's on to the Baritz, where a jolly gal shows me the efficiency for $110 a week. No TV, no linens, no dishware. What I don't like is the ground floor part, right on a well-traveled commercial street, meaning you have a choice between privacy and light. Well, that's not all I don't like, but it's enough. I'm heading back to Portland in defeat when I notice that the Blue Haven Motel on Route 1 has apartments to rent. And the place looks so cute, in an alpine sort of way, with its rows of tiny white cottages set against deep blue pines, that I stop. For $120 a week, I can have a bed-slash-living area with a kitchen growing off of it, linens included, and a TV that will have cable until the cable company notices that the former occupant is no longer paying the bill. Better yet, the security deposit is only $100, which I produce on the spot. Given a few days or weeks more to look, maybe I could have done better. But the meter is running at the rate of $59 a day for my digs at the Six, which are resembling a Ballard creation more every day. On the afternoon of my third day there, I return to my room to find that the door no longer responds to my key. As it turns out, this is just management's way of drawing my attention to the fact that more money is due. It's a bad moment, though, lasting long enough for me to glimpse a future without toothbrush or change of clothes. Now, to find a job. I know from my Key West experience to apply for as many as possible, since a help wanted ad may not mean that any help is wanted just now. Waitressing jobs aren't plentiful with the tourist season ending, and I'm looking for fresh challenges anyway. Clerical work is ruled out by wardrobe limitations. I don't have in my suitcase, or even in my closet back home, enough office-type outfits to get me through a week. So I call about cleaning, both office and homes, warehouse and nursing home work, manufacturing, and a position called General Helper, which sounds friendly and altruistic. It's humbling, this business of applying for low-wage jobs, consisting as it does of offering yourself, your energy, your smile, your real or fake lifetime of experience, to a series of people for whom this is just not a very interesting package. At a tortilla factory, where my job would be to load dough balls onto a conveyor belt, the interview is completed by a board secretary without so much as a, "Hi, how are you?" I go to Goodwill, which I'm curious about, since I know from past research it's been positioning itself nationwide as the ideal employer for the post-welfare poor, as well as the handicapped. I fill out the application and am told that the pay is $7 an hour, and that someone will get back to me in about 2 weeks. During the entire transaction, which takes place in a warehouse where perhaps 30 people of both sexes are sorting through bins of used clothing, no one makes eye contact with me. Well, actually, one person does. As I search for the exit, I notice a skinny, misshapen fellow standing on one foot with the other tucked behind his knee, staring at me balefully, his hands making swimming motions above his head, either for balance or to ward me off. Not every place is so nonchalant. At a suburban Walmart that is advertising a job fair, I'm seated at a table with some balloons attached to it. This is the fair part. To wait for Julie. She's flustered when she shows up after about a 10-minute wait because, as she explains, she just works on the floor and has never interviewed anyone before. Fortunately for her, the interview consists almost entirely of a 4-page opinion survey with no right or wrong answers, Julie assures me. Just my own personal opinion in 10 degrees from totally agree to totally disagree. Personality testing in the workplace is at an all-time high and now supports a $400 million a year industry. As with the Winn-Dixie pre-employment test I took in Key West, there are the usual questions about whether a co-worker observed stealing should be forgiven or denounced, whether management is to blame if things go wrong, and if it's all right to be late when you have a good excuse. The only thing that distinguishes this test is its obsession with marijuana. Suggesting that it was authored by a serious stoner struggling to adjust to the corporate way of life. Among the propositions I am asked to opine about are, some people work better when they're a little bit high. Everyone tries marijuana. And, bafflingly, marijuana is the same as a drink. What kind of drink? I want to ask. The same. How? Chemically or morally? Or should I write in something flippant like, I wouldn't know because I don't drink? The pay is $6.50, Julie tells me, but can shoot up to $7 pretty fast. She thinks I would be great in the ladies' department, and I tell her I think so too. What these tests tell employers about potential employees is hard to imagine, since the right answers should be obvious to anyone who has ever encountered the principle of hierarchy and subordination. Do I work well with others? You bet, but never to the point where I would hesitate to inform on them for the slightest infraction. Am I capable of independent decision-making? Oh, yes. But I know better than to let this capacity interfere with a slavish obedience to orders. At the maid's, a house cleaning service, I'm given something called the AccuTrack personality test, which warns at the beginning that AccuTrack has multiple measures which detect attempts to distort or psych out the questionnaire. Naturally, I never find it hard to stop moods of self-pity. Nor do I imagine that others are talking about me behind my back, or believe that management and employees will always be in conflict because they have totally different sets of goals. The real function of these tests, I decide, is to convey information not to the employer, but to the potential employee. And the information being conveyed is always, "You will have no secrets from us. We don't just want your muscles and that portion of your brain that's directly connected to them. We want your innermost self." The main thing I learn from the job hunting process is that, despite all the help-wanted ads and job fairs, Portland is just another $6 to $7 an hour town. This should be as startling to economists as a burst of exotic radiation is to astronomers. If the supply of labor is low relative to demand, the price should rise, right? That is the law. At one of the maid services I apply at, Merry Maids, my potential boss keeps me for an hour and 15 minutes, most of which is spent listening to her complain about the difficulty of finding reliable help. It's easy enough to think of a solution, because she's offering $200 to $250 a week for an average of 40 hours work. "Don't try to put that into dollars per hour," she warns, seeing my brow furrow as I tackle the not very long division. "We don't calculate it that way." I do, however, and $5 to $6 an hour for what this lady freely admits is heavy labor with a high risk of repetitive stress injuries seems guaranteed to repel all mathematically able job seekers. But I'm realizing that, just as in Key West, one job will never be enough. In the new version of the law of supply and demand, jobs are so cheap, as measured by the pay, that a worker is encouraged to take on as many of them as she possibly can. After 2 days of sprinkling job applications throughout the greater Portland area, I force myself to sit in my room at the Six, where I'm marooned until the Blue Haven will let me in on Sunday, and wait for the phone to ring. This takes more effort than you might think, because the room's too small for pacing and too dingy for daydreaming, should I have been calm enough to give that a try. Fortunately, the phone rings twice before noon, and, more out of claustrophobia than any serious economic calculation, I accept the first two jobs that are offered. A nursing home wants me on weekends for $7 an hour, starting tomorrow. The maids is pleased to announce that I passed the AccuTrack test and can start on Monday at 7:30 a.m. This is the friendliest and best-paying maid service I've encountered, $6.65 an hour. Though, as a punishment, this will drop to $6 for 2 weeks if I fail to show up for a day. The Bureau of Labor Statistics found full-time private household workers and servants earning a median income of $223 a week in 1998, which is $23 a week below the poverty level for a family of three. For a 40-hour week, our pay at the maids would amount to $266, or $43 above the poverty level. I don't understand exactly what maid services do and how they're different from agencies, but Tammy, the office manager at the maids, assures me that the work will be familiar and easy, since cleaning is in our blood. I'm not so sure about the easy part after the warnings I got at Merry Maids, but I figure my back should be able to hold out for a week. We're supposed to be done about 3:30 every day, which will leave plenty of time for job hunting on weekday afternoons. I have my eye on a potato chip factory, a 10-minute drive from the Blue Haven, for example. Or I can always search out L.L. Bean and fill catalog orders from what I hope will be an ergonomically congenial seat. This is beginning to look like a plan. From maid service to something better, with the nursing home tiding me over during the transition. To celebrate, I eat dinner at Applebee's. A burger and a glass of red wine for $11.95 plus tip, consumed at the bar while involuntarily watching ESPN. On my fourth full day in Portland, I get up at 4:45 to be sure to get to the Woodcrest Residential Facility, not its real name, for the start of my shift at 7 o'clock. I'm a dietary aide, which sounds important and technical. And at first, the work seems agreeable enough. I get to wear my own clothes, meaning T-shirt and khakis or jeans, augmented only by the mandatory hairnet and an apron at my own discretion. I don't even have to bring lunch, since we get to eat anything left over after the residents, as we respectfully call them, have eaten their share. Linda, my supervisor, a kindly-looking woman of about 30, even takes time to brief me about my rights. I don't have to put up with any sexual harassment, particularly from Robert, even though he's the owner's son. Any problems, and I'm to come straight to her. And I get the feeling she'd appreciate getting a Robert-related complaint now and then. On the other hand, there is severe discipline for screw-ups that could endanger lives. Like when some of the teenage boys who work on weekends put butter pats in a light fixture, and the melted butter leaked onto the floor, creating a hazardously slippery region. Not that she expects that kind of thing from me. Today we'll be working the locked Alzheimer's ward, bringing breakfast from the main kitchen downstairs to the smaller kitchen on the ward, serving the residents, cleaning up afterward, and then readying ourselves for their lunch. For a former waitress such as myself, this is pretty much a breeze. The residents start drifting in 40 minutes before breakfast is ready, by walker and wheelchair or just marching stiffly on their own power, and scuffle briefly over who sits where. I rush around pouring coffee. Decaf only, Linda warns. Otherwise things can get pretty wild. And taking orders, trying to think of it as a restaurant. Although in a normal restaurant, I cannot help but thinking, very few customers smell like they're carrying a fresh dump in their undies. If someone rejects the French toast we're offering, Linda and I make toast or a peanut butter sandwich, because the idea, especially at breakfast, is to get them eating fast before they collapse into their plates from low blood sugar or escape back out into the corridor. There's a certain amount of running, but no big worry about forgetting things. Our customers aren't strong in the memory department themselves. I make an effort to learn names. Marguerite, who arrives in the dining room clutching a teddy bear and wearing nothing but a diaper below the waist. Grace, who tracks me with an accusing stare and demands that her cup be refilled, even when it hasn't been touched. Letty, a diabetic who has to be watched because she sneaks donuts from other people's plates. Ruthie, who softens her French toast by pouring orange juice over it and much of the table, is one of the more with-it gals. She asks my name, and when I tell her, she hoots, "Barbara Bush!" Despite my vigorous protestations, the joke is repeated twice during the breakfast service. The ugly part is cleaning up. I hadn't realized that a dietary aide is, in large measure, a dishwasher. And there are about 40 people, counting the nurses and CNAs, certified nursing assistants, who have scrounged breakfasts with the residents to clean up after. You scrape uneaten food off the dishes and into the disposal by hand. Rinse the dishes, pre-soak them, stack them in a rack, and load the rack into the dishwashing machine, which involves bending down almost to floor level with the full rack, which I would guess at about 15 to 20 pounds, held out in front of you. After the machine has run its course, you let the dishes cool enough to handle, unload the rack, and reload the dishwasher, all the while continuing to clear tables and fetch meals for stragglers. The trick is to always have a new rack ready to go into the machine the minute the last load is done. I've been washing dishes since I was 6 years old, when my mother assigned me that task so she could enjoy her postprandial cigarette in a timely fashion. And I kind of like working with water. But it's all I can do to keep up with the pace of the dishwashing machine on the one hand and the flow of dirty plates on the other. With the dishes under control, Linda has me vacuum the carpet in the dining room, which really doesn't do anything for the sticky patches, so there's a lot of climbing under tables and scratching mushed muffins off the floor with my fingernails. At my mid-morning break, I join Pete, one of the two cooks on duty in the main kitchen, for a cigarette date. I had chatted with him when I first arrived at 7, before Linda showed up, and he had 3 questions for me. Where was I from? Where was I living now? Was I married? I give him the short answer to the last question, leaving out the boyfriend for the moment, partly because it doesn't make sense to talk about the man I live with when I'm not living with him just now, and partly, I admit, because of a craven desire to recruit Pete as an ally, on whatever terms should present themselves. A dietary aide, as I understand the job, is as dependent on a cook as a waitress is. He or she can either make life relatively easy for a server or, if so disposed, set her up for a serious fall. So I go out to the parking lot with him and sit in his car smoking his Marlboros, which feels awkwardly like a real date, except that the car doors are wide open to let out the smoke. How do I like the place? Just fine, I tell him. And since my dad ended his days in an Alzheimer's facility, I feel almost at home. Which is, creepily enough, the truth. Well, watch out for Molly, he warns me. She's good to work with, but she'll stab you in the back. Linda's okay, but she came down hard on Pete last week for letting a dessert slip onto a diabetic's tray. Residents who can't make it to the dining room have trays made up for them in the kitchen. And what does she think this is, a goddamn hospital? Look, nobody gets out of here alive. Watch out for Leon, too, who has a habit of following his female co-workers into service closets. In fact, watch out for everyone, because the place feeds on gossip, and whatever you say will be public knowledge in a matter of hours. And what do I do for excitement? Oh, read, I tell him. No drinking or carousing? I shake my head primly, feeling like a real goody-goody, or at least a barren subject for the gossips, present company included. I should make it clear that we're not talking about boyfriend material here. Pete is probably 10 years my junior, though he doesn't seem to realize that, and I see no reason to point it out. And despite a striking resemblance to a currently popular comic actor, has no evident sense of humor. If his story is to be believed, he's as much an impostor as I am. Though, of course, he doesn't know that either. See, he makes only $7 an hour himself, he tells me, though he's made a hell of a lot more in restaurants. But it doesn't bother him, on account of some big gambling wins a few years ago and clever investments since. If he's so rich, I can't help wondering, then why is he driving this rusty old wreck? And how come his front teeth are so scraggly and sparse? And what is a self-respecting restaurant cook doing in this flavor-free environment anyway, where a third to a half of the meals get pureed as soon as they're prepared?